Hare Krishna. Today we're reading from the third canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 3, entitled The Lord's Pastimes Outside of Vrindavan, I believe. And we're reading from verses 11 to 13. Yeah, 11 and 12 don't have a purport, so I'll just recite the Sanskrit best I can. Translation. Of kings like Shambhar, Devida, Bana, Mura, Balava, and many other demons such as Dantavakra, some he killed himself and some he caused to be killed by others, Sri Baladev, etc. Verse 12. Then, O Vidura, the Lord caused all the kings, both the enemies and those on the side of your fighting nephews, to be killed in the battle of Kurukshetra. All those kings were so great and strong that the earth seemed to shake as they traversed the war field. Verse 13, translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Translation. Duryodhan was bereft of his fortune and duration of life because of the intricacy of ill advice given by Karna, Dushasan, and Sobal. When he lay on the ground with his followers, his thighs broken, although he was powerful, the Lord was not happy to see the scene. Purport. The fall of Duryodhan, the leading son of Dhritarashtra, was not pleasing to the Lord, although he was on the side of Arjuna, and it was he who advised Bhim how to break the thighs of Duryodhan while the fight was going on. The Lord is constrained to award punishment upon the wrongdoer, but he is not happy to award such punishments, because the living entities are originally his parts and parcels. He is harder than the thunderbolt for the wrongdoer, and softer than the rose for the faithful. The wrongdoer is misled by bad associates and by ill advice, which is against the established principles of the Lord's order, and thus he becomes subject to punishment. The surest path to happiness is to live by the principles laid out by the Lord and not disobey his established laws, which are enacted in the Vedas and the Puranas for the forgetful living entities. Om Agyanti Mirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmei Shri Guruve Namaha Shri Chaitanya Abno Bhishtam Sapitam Yena Bhutale Svayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Svapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatan Vitam Tvam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandhu Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavanishwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhya Evacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Karadha Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Prishnaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swamnita Namine Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschajale Shudhani Hare Krishna. Before Kaviraj Goswami starts to narrate the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya, he quotes, or he writes one beautiful verse. He says, Murko nicha shudramani vishaya lalas vaishnavagya balakare etika sahas. He says that he feels that he's a fool. He says that he feels that he's low-born, that he's very fallen, that he's always desiring sense gratification. However, by the instruction and order of the Vaishnavas, he is feeling strengthened and enlivened in his writing and in his pursuits. So Kaviraj Goswami speaks from his humility. For me, it's my reality, so I'm humbly begging for the blessings of all of you, particularly my seniors who've spent so much time cultivating me, looking after me. Govind Prabhu, Parama Prabhu, Prayojan Prabhu, seeking the blessings of all Srinivas Prabhu, and that I can be be a via medium, and that all of my innumerable material desires can be cast aside by this humble saver. So please, seeking your blessings. We're at the third chapter of the third canto, and it's explained in the Padma Purana that the first two cantos of the Lord represent, the first two cantos of the Bhagavatam, excuse me, represent the Lord's resplendent lotus feet. And the third and fourth cantos of the Bhagavatam, they represent the thighs of the Lord. I thought it's quite interesting that they represent the thighs, and here we are discussing the Lord's desiring to break Duryodhana's thighs. He keeps the vow of Bhim, who had made this unbreakable vow, so to speak, that he would break Duryodhana's thighs. In the first chapter of the third canto, we hear of how Vidura was insulted by the Kauravas. Despite him attempting to give good counsel, he was cast aside by Dhritarashtra and Duryodhana. And being hurt and being insulted, seeing that his advice and his counsel was a lost cause in that assembly, he decided to renounce it, give it up, and go on pilgrimage. He visits different holy places, and whilst he's visiting these different holy places, he comes to the understanding that the Pandavas were victorious in the battle of Kurukshetra, and he becomes happy and rejoices in that fact. Then in the second chapter, towards the end of the first chapter, he then goes to the bank of the Yamuna, and he meets with Uddhav. They embrace, and they start to, Vidura starts to inquire from Uddhav about the activities of the Lord. At this moment, the Lord has now departed this world, and Uddhav, in separation, starts to feel some levels of ecstatic symptoms. Then goes on to explain the second chapter about the different activities of the Lord in Vrindavan. Then we come to this third chapter, where Uddhav is speaking of Krishna's activities outside of Vrindavan. And in the earlier verses, we're going through his killing of Kamsa, his study in the Gurukul, his marriage of Rukmini, his stealing of the Parijata tree from Indra, etc. And then we come to this particular verse where Krishna particularly points out the negative influence of what Srila Vyasadeva elsewhere calls the Dushta Chatushyata, the four evils in the Mahabharata. Duryodhan, Karna, Dushasan, and Shakuni. Now, these are individuals you definitely don't want to invite to your next house program. and it's this advice and this scheming of this little clique that ultimately leads to the premature death of Duryodhan and robs him of all of his assets. We see this theme of destructive association and negative sangha crop up again and again throughout the varieties of epics that we have the fortune of being exposed to. In the Mahabharata, in the Ramayana, we of course hear of Mantara. Mantara was the leading maidservant in the camp of Kekai. Kekai was the favored wife of King Dasharath, and her son was Bharat. Ram was the elder son of Dasharath, and his mother was Kekai, who was also a queen of Dasharath, but she was kind of number two, maybe number three in that ranking system. But Kekai was very much the favorite. So Mantara, having heard that it would be Ram and not Bharat who would be crowned the king of Ayodhya after Dasharath's kind of handing over, she becomes quite insecure. Because of her physical appearance, she was both old and she had a hunchback. And many times people would ridicule her for this. However, because she had the number one position as the top maidservant within the camp of the sovereign, she was given a level of respect. However, she felt that if Ram was to become the king, then her position as the leading maidservant would go away, and there was a level of insecurity there. So she started to then pollute the mind of Kekai. Valmiki Ramayana gives her a particular term, he calls her Papa Darshini, one who has a destructive or sinful outlook. Mantara, she then started to pollute the mind of Kekai. She said, your son Bharat, his dynasty will be completely wiped out. But Kekai wasn't really having much of it. She loved Ram equally as much as she loved Bharat. She then said that Bharat would become like the servant of Ram. He'd become a maidservant in a similar fashion. But KK was, again, completely happy at this because she loved both Ram and Bharat equally. However, then what Mantra did was she started to pick up on KK's very unique fears. She then started to say, well, if Ram becomes the king, then Kaushalya will become the favored wife of Dasharath, and therefore your position would be lost. And this is what really then starts to turn KK, and ultimately leads to a situation where her husband prematurely passes away, and Ram gets sent away and banished to the forest. And this all stemmed from a situation from which KK had accepted counsel from Mantra, who she thought was a well-wisher, but was in actuality insecure. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we hear of Kala Krishna Das. As Mahaprabhu comes back from, as Mahaprabhu goes to Puri after taking sannyas, he goes with a group of devotees. And after spending some time in Puri, Mahaprabhu is desirous to visit South India and inundate that part of India with bhakti. He had a particular vision to share bhakti throughout the entire world, and he wanted to start his mission in South India. As he's in Puri, he's surrounded with his devotees, his crew, his gang. The first person who decides that he also wants to go along with Lord Chaitanya to South India is Nityananda Prabhu. Nityananda Prabhu tells him, he says, "My Lord, you know, in South India, it's full of thieves, it's full of rogues. And also, you know, you need a sense of protection, so we should all come with you. And I myself as well, I've also been to South India before. I know all the different holy places, and therefore I can come and take you to these different places." But Mahaprabhu, he's not having any of it. He says, "Oh Nitai," he says, "I'm just a dancer, and you are like the puppet you're like the puppet master pulling my strings." He says, "When I wanted to go to Vrindavan, you took me to Shantipur instead." He said, "When I asked you to hold my clothes, instead you broke my dunder. So how can I trust that you'll actually take me to South India? If actually you come with me, I won't even know where we'll get to." So he says that, and then he starts to criticize the other devotees in a loving mood, of course, around him. He says, and Jagatananda, he says, "Jagatananda, all he cares about is bodily comforts. And because I'm scared of him, I do whatever he tells me to do. Otherwise, you know, he'll become upset and he won't talk to me for 3 days. He says, and then Mukunda, when he sees that I'm performing the austerities of a sannyasi, he also becomes upset and unhappy. And seeing his unhappiness, I become twice as unhappy." Then he points to Damodar and he says, and Damodar, he treats me like I'm the brahmachari and he's the sannyasi. He just instructs me and he tells me what to do. He says, none of you really understand the social etiquettes and the social opinion. Therefore, it's better that I go by myself. So Nityananda Prabhu then suggests Kala Krishnadas to go with Lord Chaitanya so that he can accompany him and look after him and carry his equipment effectively. They go traveling to different places in South India, Kanchipuram, Srirangam, Tirupati, and then they come to a place called Vetapani, and they come across a group called the Bhattaharis. The Bhattaharis are nomads, and they have some sense of mystical power where they can pull people into their camp. And somehow or other, Kala Krishnadas, despite having the direct association of the Lord, he was pulled into that camp to such an extent that even though Kala Krishnadas is meant to be the servant of the Lord, it was the Lord who had to then end up serving him by pulling him out of that camp by his shika. So we then come to here in the Mahabharata, where we have Duryodhan, who's put himself in a situation where he's created his advisory board of very ill-advised, insecure, and envious individuals. There's a famous analogy given in the Hari Bhakti Suddhodaya, and that one develops qualities similar to those with whom one associates, just like a jewel picks up colors according to its surroundings. And therefore a wise person will take shelter of those of superior quality to raise his own qualities. So this is a key aspect of Vaishnav conduct, of the renunciation of negative association, of the analysis of which association is actually beneficial for us, and which is not. And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in his commentary on this topic, he says that there is no better sadhana for a jiva than to give up bad association. One who keeps bad company can never reap good results, even after following thousands of sadhanas. And Mahaprabhu, in his instructions on bhakti, he similarly quotes this verse, Asat Sangatyag E Vaishnavachar Stri Sangi Ekasada Krishna Bhakta Ar. That what is Vaishnavachar? What is the conduct of one that's aspiring for the path of bhakti? Asat Sangatyag, it is he who renounces that association of worldly minded individuals against the path of bhakti. And we see Rupa Goswami in his Upadeshamrit that Srila Prabhupada translates as the Nectar of Instruction. He, in two verses, he goes through some aspects that are regressive for bhakti and other aspects that are progressive for bhakti. In the aspects that are regressive for bhakti, he lists Janasanga, that association which is materialistic, as that which is an impediment on the path. And similarly, in terms of that which is progressive, that which is a sadhana, he says that to give up such association, that is that activity will then help us progress in our devotional path. So no other trait or no other activity was listed by Rupa Goswami in two consecutive verses in such a way, again outlining just how essential this quality is. So we know that negative association, asatsanga, is detrimental for us. And why exactly is it? And Krishna, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in the next verse, he quotes this verse from the Bhagavatam. Satyam shocham dayamonam bhudi shiri yashashama shamodamo bhagasheti yat sangatyati sangshayam. He says that one becomes devoid of truthfulness, cleanliness, mercy, gravity, spiritual intelligence, shyness, etc. By the association of such negative individuals. So such association means we take on the value system that is antithetical to bhakti, because such association makes us devoid of the qualities that we've been striving so hard to cultivate. How long have we been striving to cultivate truthfulness, honesty, humility, control of the senses? Yet all of this diminishes very quickly by accepting asat sangatyag. So what exactly counts as association? Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he also writes, he says that by sitting in one place or by crossing a boat, this isn't classified as association. But any action which is done with both love and attention, and attachment, this is called association. So, don't know how many of us ride a boat on a day-to-day basis, probably not many. but, you know, taking the train with someone, sitting in the vicinity of an individual, this doesn't necessarily count as association. But when there is exchange with both love and attachment, that is when there are qualities that are going to and fro. So the question then arises, what are the different categories of asatsanga? And Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he also writes this, and he also elucidates on this in his Chaitanya Shikshamrit. The first type of asatsanga, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur classifies as one who is both immoral and irreligious. He says that if someone is lacking both morality and a connection to divinity, these individuals wreak havoc on the world because their sole desire is purely hedonistic pursuit and the exploitation of all around them. The second type of asatsanga is that individual that has a sense of morality but is irreligious. And I think we'll find in society, particularly society trends towards more secular values, this tends to become the norm. You might see honorable initiatives, whether it be the sustainability environmentalist movement in the world, yet it is ultimately coming from a place of humanism, moralism, but without lacking an aspect of divine connection. And what happens is such people will sacrifice these so-called morals for their own self-pursuit if the opportunity were to arise. And therefore we understand that there is no real permanent morality without a theological basis. The third type of asatsanga that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur outlines is an individual that is both moral and religious, but whose concept of divinity is subservient to morality. So these types of individuals will often worship the Lord. They will worship the Lord for the purpose of gaining good conduct. However, once that good conduct has been achieved, they then cease their worship of the Lord, having achieved their goal. So these individuals, they might be quite pious actually, but they sell themselves short because they don't really reap the real benefit of performing aspects of servitude towards the Lord. The fourth category of asatsanga that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur outlines is what he calls pretenders and their followers. So these are individuals that may externally dress in the garb of a Vaishnav, may externally be practicing the day-to-day sadhanas of a Vaishnav, but internally their mood is really to desire wealth and sensuality. Now, whilst they might appear to be saintly, their motives are actually quite manipulative. And he gives an analogy, I think he quotes from somewhere, I can't remember where exactly, that as a hunter tries to capture animals by spreading out his net, similarly, the cheetah captures the money of people by pious activities. So them and their followers, this is another type of asatsanga that a Vaishnava should try to avoid. The fifth is impersonalists who don't accept the eternal nature either of devotional life or of the Lord Himself. And you know, you can pick up any book of Srila Prabhupada and he'll give you much more detail. And finally is the polytheists who don't have a sense of one-pointed focus in servitude and surrender to the Lord. So these are the six types of asatsanga that Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur outlines, that we as Vaishnavas should be careful in dealing with them and avoid such intimate association. Then we ultimately come to the Mahabharata and this verse here where we learn about Duryodhan and his selection of his advisory board. And in the Mahabharata, every single personality has a particular, there are certain personalities that have a particular type of anartha or negative trait that they personify. In the case of Duryodhan, that negative trait is envy. Duryodhan is the personification of envy. As Vaishnavas and as aspiring bhaktas, this understanding of envy is so essential because for different paths, there are certain traits that are necessary in order to be successful. For those that are on the path of karma or the karmis, adherence to strict Vedic injunctions is the key principle of success. For those on the path of jnana, the key principle to success is renunciation from material pleasure. And for the bhaktas, there is one quality that determines one's successful advancement towards prema, and that is to become free from envy. In the second verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam, the Bhagavatam is of course Nigamakalpa Taror Kalitam Phalam, the ripened fruit of all Vedic literatures. And it's written by Vyasadeva at the peak of his realization. In the second verse, it starts off by saying, Dharma projita kaita vatra paramo niramat sharanam satam. That this Bhagavatam has come to reject all materially motivated religion, all materially motivated spiritual paths. And it is understood by one who is niramat sharanam, that one who is completely free from envy. Envy is the opposite of love, actually, because bhakti is a state whereby which one aspires to be the instrument of good fortune and success and servitude of others in service to the Lord. And where you have envy that is marked by competition, bhakti is marked by cooperation. Where you have envy that is marked by arrogance, bhakti is marked by appreciation. We have envy that is marked by selfishness, bhakti is marked by servitude. And there's been some academic research into envy of late. Over the last 10, 15 years, it's been quite an interesting topic for some academic researchers. And they've effectively categorized envy into two different camps, or two different types of envy. One type of envy is called benign envy. This is a type of envy where we might see someone succeeding, and it kind of does lead to a level of insecurity within us, but it also actually propels us towards becoming inspired by what they do, and it's formed as a basis of inspiration and transformation. So that's benign envy. And then you also have something called malicious envy, which is very destructive, where we actually then desire, we see someone else excelling and progressing ahead of us, and then we really do desire their downfall. And in the case of Duryodhan, we see this come up time and time again. And for the last part of the class, I thought to share some interesting insights from His Holiness Bhaktivedanta Maharaj, who I think he gave a class here a number of years ago on the evolution of envy and how envy develops within our own lives and what to kind of watch out for. The first step to envy developing in one's life is this state called avagya. Avagya means we have a sense of superiority over someone. We think we're better than them. We have a sense of pride. And at least for me, my mind will often give me multiple different reasons to think that I'm better than someone else, to think that I'm superior to someone else. Because of this slightly offensive attitude, we then stop being respectful to individuals and act again with them from a platform of superiority rather than a platform of servitude. And it's actually at this stage, it's quite easy to detect and it's quite easy to remediate. But as envy then progresses, it becomes more and more difficult. So it's one for us to look out for. And in the case of Duryodhan, this was extremely evident, particularly from his youth. You can say that he was effectively born with a silver spoon in his mouth. His father was the king, and many in the kingdom expected him to then become the king as well. And knowing that he was going to be the future king of Hastinapur, he treated everyone with a sense of pride, with a sense of arrogance. I really looked down on other people and actually often tended to exploit people. However, as the Pandavas returned to Hastinapur and everyone realized that in actuality Pandu did have some sons who could take the reign, the Pandavas, with their natural humility, their natural culture, their natural respect towards their elders and those around them, they really developed, they won the hearts of all around them. And Duryodhan, he couldn't stand this because he saw them taking something which he felt was rightfully theirs. This aspect of Duryodhan feeling superior to others was quite well depicted when he was in the Gurukul, Gurukul of Dronacharya. Dronacharya, he loved to study his disciples' mindsets, and he'd often give them different tasks to really, one, understand them better, and two, mold them into becoming better students and hopefully ultimately better individuals. So one day he calls Duryodhan over and he says, "Duryodhan, I've got a great task for you. I think you're the right person for this task." He says, "I want you to go into the city and I want you to go to and find someone who is better than you." And Duryodhan, he gets really excited by this task and he decides to devise a plan. He's come up with a questionnaire. He's going to ask different people these different questions to find someone who's better than him, and he wants to compare his own strengths with them. So he goes to the city, he then starts to use his questionnaire, he starts to ask people, interrogate them. After some time, he actually just abandons his questionnaire, and he starts to, just by looking at them, he's able to detect their defects. So he does this again and again and again in the city, and after he comes back to seeing Dronacharya, he says, "My dear teacher, I have completed your task. And I can safely say that I have not found anyone better than me in the city." He says that everyone I've seen had a defect that I didn't have, and I had the strength that they didn't have. Therefore, I haven't found anyone better than me. So Dronacharya, he accepts this answer, but he doesn't really say anything. Instead, he waits, and he's looking at the gate. And he's waiting for someone to come to the gate, and after some time, Yudhishthira comes. And Dronacharya, he's given Yudhishthira a very similar task. And Yudhishthira also responds and he comes back with a negative answer. However, the question that Dronacharya gave Yudhishthira was that of trying to find someone worse than Yudhishthira. And Yudhishthira comes back and he says, "My dear teacher," he says, "I've gone throughout the entire city, I've interviewed everyone, and I can safely say I can't find anyone worse than me." He says that "I have found in every other person a quality that I want to learn from them." And Dronacharya, he stands between Yudhishthira and Duryodhan, and he looks at Duryodhan and he says, "Duryodhan, I found someone who's better than you, Yudhishthira." And then he looks at Yudhishthira and he says, "I found someone worse than you, Duryodhan." So Duryodhan represents, and you know, this from a very young age, we got to see the sense of avagya, the sense of superiority complex that he had. And oftentimes in our devotional life, in my devotional life, I can very much have this quality. Avagya, when it's unchecked, this sense of superiority, then leads to something called upeksha. Upeksha occurs when we want to avoid someone. We create a distance between them. Being in their presence makes us feel uncomfortable because actually our ego gets hurt. We have a sense of pride that is perhaps, you know, attacked. And just by seeing that person, by being around them, we have a sense of unpleasantness that we think is actually caused by them, but in actuality is really caused by our own insecurity. It's said that it said that for Duryodhan, this aspect of upeksha, wanting to avoid the Pandavas, manifested when after some time, after Akrura came to the kingdom of Hastinapur. He came and he met with King Dhritarashtra. Shri Shri Radha Gokula Nanda Bhagavan ki jai, Shri Shri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman ki, Shri Shri Gaur Nitai ki jai, Shri La Prabhupada ki jai. After some time had passed, Akrura, who had come to the kingdom of Hastinapur to try to provide good counsel to King Dhritarashtra. And he emphasized that Dhritarashtra should stop persecuting the Pandavas and should stop favoring his own sons and stop having this aspect of nepotism, and also return the Pandavas' rightful share of the kingdom, which was ultimately theirs. Dhritarashtra was just the caretaker, in one sense. And Dhritarashtra, kind of having heard the good counsel of Akrura, also felt similarly that he should give the kingdom rightfully to the Pandavas. And after Duryodhan hears this, again, something that he thinks is rightfully his is being snatched away from him. He becomes extremely envious, and he wants to create a distance between himself and the Pandavas. In this sense, he then brings his little gang together of Karna, Dushasan, and Shakuni, and they start to plan. They start to plan what are they going to do with the Pandavas, and they come up with this plan to send them to Varanavat and to try to effectively kill them there by burning down their house. So this is how Duryodhana exhibits this quality as well. He wants to send the Pandavas away. He doesn't want to have the discomfort of being in a kingdom that's ruled by them. And this is where he exhibits upeksha. Upeksha then leads to dvesha. Dvesha means hatred. It's where we want something terribly bad to happen to that person. We develop a separatist mentality. Someone is suffering, we don't feel their suffering. We actually get joyful in seeing their suffering. And for Duryodhan, this moment came when he visited Indraprastha. Now at this moment, the Pandavas were given half of the kingdom and the Kauravas were given another half of the kingdom. The Pandavas were basically given like the rubbish part of the kingdom. It's all overgrown, it was barren land, it was... no one really wanted to live there. It's filled with demons as well. And anyway, by the help of Krishna, they managed to make this into a beautiful town and city called Indraprastha. And they also conquered different areas and lands around them. And the amount of land they managed grows so much so that it's more than the Kauravas. And Duryodhan, again, his envy grows and grows and grows, and he visits Indraprastha. And when he visits Indraprastha, he sees the beauty that they've created around them. And he visits a celestial hall called the Maya Sabha. As he goes and he visits this celestial hall, he's again enamored by the beauty of it, by the architecture, by the creations, by the chandeliers, etc. And what he doesn't know is that this palace also has a level of optical illusions to it. So... as he's walking on a marble floor, and he comes across this pond. And now the pond, the water is extremely still, such that he thinks the water is actually just a continuation of the floor. And as he starts to walk on the water, and he falls right into the middle of the pond. As he gets out of this pond, he hears her laughing all around him. He hears the Pandavas laughing. He hears the queens laughing. But specifically, he hears Draupadi laughing at him. And this was unbearable for Duryodhan, because previously in Draupadi's Swayamvar, he wanted to actually win her hand in marriage. And this was particularly painful for Duryodhan. And after this, he developed a real sense of hatred, both towards Draupadi and the Pandavas as a whole. So it's this that you could say was a bit of a turning point in the Mahabharata of this reaction that Draupadi had towards Duryodhan. And ultimately... this leads to ninda. Avagya leads to upeksha, upeksha leads to dvesha, dvesha, if it's left unchecked, leads to ninda. And this is really where we destroy our own spiritual life, any creeper of bhakti that we've developed. Mahaprabhu calls it, the hatha-mata offense of an elephant running and breaking the seed of bhakti in one's garden that we've been striving so hard to cultivate. At the stage of dvesha, we don't actually manifest that hatred that we have, but at the stage of ninda, that's when we do. And this is when we start to criticize, we start to offend, we may start to persecute individuals. And again, you know, this Duryodhan feeling extremely hurt and humiliated by the activities of Draupadi and the Pandavas, he then starts to plan with Shakuni, he starts to plan with his father and his little clique again of how to get revenge from the Pandavas. And they come up with this idea of a dice game. And it was Shakuni who, in the middle of the gambling match, then asked Yudhishthira to stake Draupadi, his the wife of the Pandavas. And Bilva Mangal Thakur, he writes this beautiful verse. He says, Agre kurunam ata pandavanam dushashane narita vastrakesha Krishna tadakroshadananyanatha govinda damodara madhaveti. He says, Agre kurunam ata pandavanam, in the assembly of the Kurus and the Pandavas, dushashane narita vastrakesha, Dushashan pulling the hair and clothes of Draupadi. Krishna tadakroshadananyanatha, Draupadi seeing no other lord, seeing no one else who could help her except her lord, cries out, Govinda Damodar Madhava, please save me. The reason that this was a particularly big offense is that, you know, to some extent there's like a certain level of acceptance where you're battling with other Kshatriyas. Yes, you might want to fight with them. Yes, you may want to take the kingdom, even within the same family. However, when an honorable woman is insulted and exploited and taken advantage of, this has led to the destruction of dynasties again and again and again throughout our epics. We see it in the Ramayana with the exploitation of Sita, and we see it here with the exploitation of Draupadi. It's said that after this moment, Vidura, he told Dhritarashtra that Dhritarashtra kept a sacrificial fire in his palace. And it said that the moment that Draupadi was insulted, this sacrificial fire vanished for the first time throughout this entire epic. And similarly, that spark of devotion that we're trying to cultivate in our life, when we create an offense, that spark also diminishes. Now, what's beautiful in this particular verse is that despite Duryodhan's offense, despite his envy, despite his persecution towards both the Lord and the individuals that the Lord loved, still this was Krishna's reaction to seeing Duryodhan in a terrible state. Krishna, he didn't want to see Duryodhan like that, really. And it goes to prove that Krishna, he never disowns his living entity. And this also gives an insight into the mind of the Lord. That the Lord, he wasn't filled with revenge. He wasn't filled with the sense of wanting Duryodhan to be killed in such a horrific way. The Lord seeing Duryodhan, his heart broke at seeing this. Because ultimately the Lord sees us as his loving children. It was to such an extent that Duryodhan even received liberation, as it said in the Garuda Purana, that because his mind was absorbed in the Lord, he actually received a sense of liberation. For me, at least, I was personally thinking that in present society, we have a level of, you know, quite severe instability from a geopolitical perspective. 3, 4, 5 different wars taking place in different parts of the world. And I, for one, can get quite absorbed in these situations, favoring one side over another. And when I hear the other side is defeated, there's a sense of rejoicement. But Krishna never feels like that, because we're all ultimately his children. And because the Lord is ever expanding, similarly, the Lord's love for us is also ever expanding. In one sense, there's nothing that we can do that can make the Lord love us any more or any less. There's only things that we can do that allow the Lord to either reciprocate with us, like he says here, either as a thunderbolt or as a rose. And that choice is ultimately down to us, that Krishna might give us certain situations that might cause us pain. And we might also have resentment towards the Lord because of this. But in reality, this isn't necessarily what he wanted to happen. He could be shedding a tear whilst he's handing out the punishment that we perhaps might deserve. And the final point I'll just end on is on this aspect of envy. How is it that we can overcome envy when we notice it cropping up in our life? So generally it's easier to deal with envy in the first two stages, one of avagya and that of upeksha. At the stage of avagya, i.e. feeling a sense of superiority to someone else, we can learn to actually cultivate a sense of appreciation, both verbally and within our mind, learning to see the good qualities that the individual is doing and cultivate a sense of appreciation, both by expressing it to them and to others. And in the second aspect of upeksha, creating a sense of separation or segregation, instead we can create a mood of servitude towards that person. Find opportunities, find situations where we can be of service to that individual. And by both appreciating and by serving that person, the Lord will hopefully become pleased within us and uproot the negative quality of envy within the heart. So I thank you all very, very much for your time. I beg the forgiveness for speaking significantly beyond my realization. And would like to thank my seniors for kindly tolerating anything that I've shared today. I think we have maybe 2 minutes left if anyone would have any corrections or comments to share that we can send to our seniors, Prajan Prabhu.
I remember when I first came here from industry, and it was very interesting. And I was given a very funny position called temple commander. Of course, you gradually learn that actually temple commander doesn't mean temple commander. It means temple servant. Oh, actually. But what was really manifested itself, I remember seeing these people just hoarding all the money to one side. And I told them they shouldn't do this. But actually, because I'm so passionate in my nature, I was envious of them taking all the maha. And so I condemned them. And I thought, oh my God, that's me. It's just showing another trait. You point one finger at one person and there's four pointing back at you, isn't it?
Jai Shri Shri Radhika Kulnanda Bhagavan Ki Jai, Shri Shri Ram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai, Shri Shri Varnitaya Ki
Jai. Prabhupada pointed out in the animal thing, they said, can we publish these pictures of animals suffering? It will help our cause. And he says, you will not tarnish our Back to Godhead magazine. And he said, why? He says, why? Because it will only create a sentiment that, and sentiment doesn't last. It just becomes used to it. You know, it's like, you see poor people every day in London. But you've got to be very careful with who you give to, and if sentiment gets in the way, and your self-righteous attitude. You know, these people are begging. But they only want to feed their belly, or they only want alcohol. You know, it was such an eye-opener, this service, that it pointed out all my own envy. All the time I was condemning people, when actually I was just envious of them. You know, I always thought a self-righteous attitude. It was incredible. And so, there you go. Watch out for it.
Thanks, Guru. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.